Hello, hi. Welcome back to the TetraCast, episode 385, recording on March 8th, 2025. I am your substitute host, Josh Torres, filling in for Brian Vitale once again. I think he'll be back next week, but the last check-in we got from him was he was over at Medieval Times having the time of his life with a significant other. Nice to see. Joining me for this podcast, we have Adam Vitale.
Medieval Times is RPG adjacent.
That's right, yeah. I met many years ago. I really enjoyed it. We have Chow Min Wu.
How's it going? I have never seen a Medieval Times, but when I look at the picture from Ryan, I was thinking of that movie, Role Models, where they're doing those role plays with the knights and all the stuff.
I haven't thought about that movie in a really long time.
It's basically performance LARPing.
Dining, yeah. as you're getting served, you're watching like a medieval tournament, like jousting and
yeah.
Look, I saw that movie in the theaters for free because it was like a screen testing, so they want like feedback on what was wrong with the movie or what was good about the movie, because there was like some survey right at the end of the movie. Maybe I don't know. It's like maybe that my cut that I saw was probably different. I was the test screening audience.
And also joining us, we have James Galizio.
I'm sure Medieval Times is great, but honestly, it's kind of been ruined for me because of a certain story about a misplaced USB.
So, in this episode of the podcast, we have a Suikoden bonanza, I guess is the best way to put it. We had the recent release of the Suikoden 1 and 2 HD remaster with the crazy long subtitle. And also we had a Suikoden event that announced quite a bit of Suikoden stuff upcoming as Konami tries they're making their best push to revive the Suikoden IP in various ways. And then we also have a little bit of on my end, I played a little bit of Suikoden, but most of my time was spent playing Split Fiction with a friend of mine. I'll talk a little bit about that.
Look, they're even bringing back Tokimeki Memorial in Japan in May, so I don't know, maybe there would be a big Castlevania revival too. I don't know, could this be the year of Konami? We could finally forgive them.
You had the Castlevania re-releases of the ports of the GBA.
Yes, but you know, people would love to see like a sequel of some sort.
they we'll see what they decide to do. I mean, they're trying their best, like a Metal Gear, you know, the re-remake.
You'll get a gacha mobile game.
Yeah, and then James will talk about his FF14 ventures for a bit as well to round out what we've been playing, and then we'll have some news bits, quite a bit here. So let's start off right away. We'll dive in. Suikoden 1 and 2 HD Remaster. I played a tiny bit of the first Suikoden because I wanna play that one first before I check out the remaster of 2. Adam here, you've been playing them, and you beat both of them, and you have a walkthrough of one as well.
Yeah, so our reviewer on the site was Paul Screlly. He is a Suikoden fan, so sometimes for remasters, we have like a new player playing it, but sometimes we have, you know, kind of a revisit from someone familiar, and that's what we had in this case, was Paul is a fan of Suikoden, replaying these games for the first time in a while, I think. And he really liked the experience. He basically said it's better than he remembered, was his takeaway. And he scored it a 9 out of 10. Very positive review coming from the place of someone who is familiar, who is already a fan. So that is his perspective of the review. I also got early code, and I have not. I'm at the very end of Suikoden 2. I was kind of wrapping up some stuff for the, yes, like you said, guide writing purposes. Trying to put up specifically some like quick walkthroughs on the site, something that you can kind of easily reference just to make sure you're picking up all the characters and whatnot without getting too bogged down in walls of text. But anyways, yes, I played through the games. I have played through them before. I didn't play Suikoden when it originally released on PlayStation. I got to them when they released on PSN like 12 years ago or whatever.
I still have its physical copies.
Hey,
I just love how the art for the first one is like so mismatched, but what the game looks like.
The North American arc.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. By the time I got interested, like I never had a PlayStation 1, and by the time I got a PlayStation 2 and really got into RPGs, I think Suikoden 2 specifically was like $300 to buy it before it was available digitally. So I was like, yeah, no. That's not
I do have the second game physically too, but the manual's missing.
Oh, so then it's worthless.
It's not worth anything at this point. It's like,
But yeah, I remember when those games came out on PSN, Suikoden 2 specifically, it was actually kind of a big deal because like the only other way you could play it was to buy, you know, before it was available digitally, you know, a used copy for more than $200 or whatever.
Yeah, if you weren't emulating it, yeah.
Oh, right, like to purchase a copy, like yeah. Legally. But anyways, yeah, so I played through the remasters, and I agree with a lot of Paul's takes on the game. How I would approach these games is like this. This is a remaster of a PlayStation 1 RPG or a pair of PlayStation 1 RPGs, and it's pretty faithful to the original version. I actually ended up reading a handful of reviews for these games, and being as generous as possible to all different reviewers, it feels like a lot of the common consensus on these games, there's a lot of similarities in what people like and dislike in terms of what the remaster does. For example, how do I put this? This is not Suikoden 1 and 2 HD 2D remake. Like, Dragon Quest III HD 2D remake came out not that long ago, and that's, $60 for one kind of fully-fledged remake of one game. This is like a remaster bundle of two games, and so, like, the approach is a little bit different, right? This is the PlayStation 1 version ported and touched up. Actually, more specifically, it's more likely the PSP version ported and touched up. There was a PSP version of these games that released only in Japan, and that version of Suikoden already added a few components, like, for example, the widescreen layout in some respects, and also, like, moving diagonally. You couldn't move diagonally in the PlayStation 1 version. You can do that now, but that's technically not a brand new edition. That was in the PlayStation Portable version, as I understand it. I never played that version. But anyways, so these games, some people I saw were disappointed that they didn't do more with them in terms of like being like a fully fledged remake, which is totally fine and valid. But, you know, some people on the flip side were kind of happy that they stayed faithful enough to the original version. And it's very familiar in that way. So I think it's best to approach these games like kind of knowing or calibrating your expectations and like how they made this remaster. It is not a remake. It is a remaster. This is probably a little bit cynical, but it's kind of like a port with a lot of touch-ups.
I guess it's like it's a really weird thing because when you get to like the definition of remake and remaster, like remaster is like you either like have the same assets touched up, and like a remake is like all new assets, and like if we're doing it by that definition, like it's hard to remember what the original looked like from memory, right? So there's definitely like, you know, YouTube comparisons out there. Shows here's what the original looks like and here's what the remaster looks like, and you can tell like there are some quite a bit of like environmental new assets to this, right? That, you know, people will say one looks better than the other, the original looks better, the new remaster looks better, etc. And then like the quality varies between like one and two, where people believe that like, you know, the remaster of two here seems to be more faithful in that environmental asset wise than, you know, the one is, where one is, you know, there's definitely, when you see it side by side, the original and the remaster, they look significantly different because you see it them side by side. If you're trying to go up by memory, you're like, okay, I kind of remember like this, this sort of remembers what I remember one looking like. But when you see it side by side, you're like, oh, okay, it actually looks pretty different in some aspects, like, you know, like the patterns on the environmental assets, for example, like maybe a rug has a totally different design or different floor tiles or different lighting in the way that room is. So like in that sense, it's a remake in that respect, where there are definitely new assets to this that replace original assets.
Yes. Suikoden 1 was always like an uglier game than Suikoden 2, and I kind of feel like there was sort of a, you know, the Mass Effect remaster came out a couple years ago, 3 years ago, and Mass Effect 1 kind of required more touching up compared to the other ones. It's maybe not that drastic, but it kind of feels similar, where they had to do more with Suikoden 1 to try to like try to even out these two games and to maybe mixed effect. I do think when you're playing this remaster, forgetting the original, there's a pretty noticeable difference when you play one, finish it, and then go to two. It's a pretty significant jump in visual quality. And I think they just had a, you know, an easier place to start from when they're remastering it. Where Suikoden 1, like you said, they had to redo a lot of the like the backgrounds and whatnot. And some of them look totally fine, but I a lot of people mentioned it. Paul also mentioned this in his review. Just some of the backgrounds are kind of like, you know, they're okay. They're maybe not great, but they're fine. And they, you know, I don't think it's a big detractor, but it is something that is worth mentioning that these two games, there is a little bit of a visual difference between them, with two clearly being a little bit more polished. And it's a newer game, you know, so it's not not too unexpected, right?
And I, there's definitely like some people out there, some Suikoden fans out there, they're like treating this as like, I'm playing this only for Suikoden 2, and one is like kind of like a bonus game.
Yeah.
Maybe I'll get to it.
I'm kind of in the same boat, because I don't think the first game was that great, to be honest with you.
I think the first game was kind of prototypical. Like,
yeah, it's like a lot of first game. Like, even if you play like Breath of Fire, for example, it's like the first game is not that good. Then the second game, it's like, oh, this is a huge shakeup, right? You know, it's like, it takes like a sequel to get things built.
Yeah. I mean, if you think about it, though, like Suikoden 1 came out in, what, 1995? And, you know, having the six-person parties, having, you know, the different rune slots, having more than 100 recruitable characters, building your castle, like all those things were, I don't know if Suikoden was the first game to ever incorporate those elements, but to package it that in such a way was probably pretty novel at the time.
Yeah.
And so, and then like Suikoden 2 kind of took that foundation to be a little bit trite here and built upon it in a beloved sequel. And like you said, I think a lot of people might be more interested in 2 than 1. 1 is a good prelude to 2. I'll put it that way. I think it's worth playing through 1 to kind of set some, you know, get familiar with like the settings and some of the characters that are in 2. And it's only like a 20-hour game, so it's not like it's a huge, you know, endeavor to get through it, right? You can beat it in a week. But anyways, so a lot of the rough patches of the original versions on PlayStation have been sanded out. And I don't mean like in a casualization or anything. I mean like actual rough patches. For example, localization is a big one. And I've seen a couple of takes on this as well. What they decided to do, Konami decided to do, was they took the original localization, especially, this is more important for 2, I think, Suikoden 2. It's not a complete rewrite. It's the same localization touched up a fair bit in terms of dialogue and writing. There are some individual lines that are changed outright. Like I'm sure you can cherry pick certain lines that are quite different than what they were originally. But broadly, for the most part, it's the same script with a lot of touch ups overall. I have seen some people who are glad that they didn't rewrite the whole thing. Maybe running into like what you see with like Chrono Trigger or something, or Final Fantasy Tactics or Tactics Ogre, where there are like an old localization and a new localization, and some people might prefer one over the other.
I think maybe like Star Ocean is probably closer, maybe.
Like the Star Ocean 2 and Star Ocean 2 PSP?
Yeah, I find those remasters are pretty close, but it's like it's a little bit touched up, right? It like fix up some grammar issues and stuff, or something like that.
There's a lot of the original translation was sort of notorious for a lot of like punctuation, exclamation points and ellipses and things like that, but not just that, also it was definitely a bit stiff, and the game's writing kind of shone through it in spite of kind of an iffy localization. But it's, I think broadly overall it flows a lot better, but it stays faithful. And again, I have seen some people who are like, man, they should have just rewrote the whole thing from scratch. But then I also see some people are like, I'm glad they didn't rewrite the whole thing from scratch. So it's, you know, I guess it just depends on your perspective. It's a faithful remake.
Mm-hmm.
So, or remaster, not remake. But I think that's kind of the approach that Konami went with in a lot of respects, is that they wanted to sand off some of the rough edges of the original without like changing it too much. And I think in some ways it was smart. For example, a lot of the sprites, like the character sprites, are basically the same they were before. They're not new sprites, which honestly, if they were to remake the sprites in this game, that would be a massive endeavor. This isn't Dragon Quest. This isn't old Final Fantasy. The sprite animations in this game, there are a lot of sprites, and more than just the fact that there are more than 100 characters. It's just all the ways that the sprites animate throughout the game, throughout the story, throughout the mini games. There are a lot of sprites. If they were to redo those, that would be a huge endeavor.
Yeah, to give people like an idea, like these are properly like ratioed sprites, where like it's not like squished down or anything. Like these are actually like normal proportions of what a human being is, but like composed comprised of sprites at that time. And since you have like so many characters, up to 6 characters in battle, the way that the camera shifts during it, they have to make different sprites for like different camera angles, and especially during animations, because animations are not like, they're not always facing the same way during animations for their attacks or co-op attacks.
And you're absolutely right. All the co-op attacks or the unite attacks have all these different animations for a lot of the different characters. But even during the story, there are things like there's, for example, there's a couple of scenes with like Clive, for example, picks up a gun off the ground and you have to animate the sprite doing that. Mm-hmm. It's just something as simple as the sprite bending over, picking up something off the ground. But they had to draw those, right? There's a couple of scenes where like Nanami sits down on the floor and like you had to animate that. You don't see that in like Pixel Remaster or something, right?
Yeah.
So I think this was the smartest option, is just to leave the sprites as they are. There's no smoothing, so it's not like Grandia, where you just kind of have, Grandia's remaster, you kind of just have to deal with it. There's smoothing on the sprites.
I'm glad that we're starting to like really embrace pixels again, you know? It really warms my heart in that aspect.
Either you keep the pixels or you add a scanline filter. It's like, fuck smoothing. You guys go to hell. Anybody that prefers smoothing, it's like, there's no friends of mine.
Holy shit. Also another big one that they had in these remasters was the portraits. The portraits are now like properly HD portraits. Original character designer and artist of the first Suikoden game, Junko Kawano, touched up the portraits for both games, but Kawano was not the character artist of the second game. That was Fumi Ishikawa. Unfortunately Fumi Ishikawa isn't involved in this.
Just to clarify just a little bit, the portraits for the first game are new. They're brand new. From the original artist. So there's, you know, it's the same artist drawing new portraits. But if you look at the original art between Suikoden 1 and Suikoden 2, like the original games, it is pretty different. Like the portrait art. I don't have an example to show you in the chat, but like look at, for example, Flick, for instance, between the two games. He looks pretty different. Just different style of art. So in the remaster, they redid the art for the original game, for the portraits. It would have been nice if they had a toggle for the original portraits. Like, I don't see why that you couldn't do that. It's like, but they didn't. You know, small missed opportunity, I guess. The second game, they're not new portraits. It is more just the old portraits upscaled. Yeah. The first game's art and portraits are brand new.
Yeah.
All right. The biggest missed opportunity in the remasters. Pretty much every single review I read said this, whether they were a positive review or a negative review. The item management. So how the item management works in these games, it's a little different between the two titles. In Suikoden 1, all of your items are basically held by your characters. Basically, everything you pick up, whether it's a potion or an equipment or whatever, has to be held by one of your individual party members. And when you have, I don't know, 70 playable characters that could hold items, what you end up sometimes doing is you're like, oh, I know I picked up this rune that I want to equip on someone. Now, where did I put it? Is it in my storage, which you eventually get? Nope. Well, it's on one of my characters. Maybe I'll just cycle in these characters in my party. Do any of these characters have it? Nope, I guess not. Let me cycle them out, cycle in these characters into my party and look through their inventories. Do they have this item? Nope. Let me check again and eventually, there it is. So you're shuffling through basically individual inventories of like 70 characters, all the playable ones. And you can put stuff in storage, but still, personally, what I would like to have seen is... you already can get a menu where you can see what each character's like stats are and what their equipment is and what their runes are. Even if they're not in your party, you can cycle through all of that, but you can't see what's in their inventory, unless I missed it. And it's just kind of a big bummer that this remaster does make some quality of life changes, but you, that's not one of them. It's just a, I think this opportunity is the
oversight. Yeah.
Yeah, it's just like, I don't know how difficult that would have been to implement, but I wish they went that mile to do it, because it is clearly the biggest hurdle. I think easily the biggest missed opportunity. So like in the original version, you could maybe argue, oh, you know, memory limitations or whatnot. It's like, you could definitely not an issue anymore. I feel like you could, it could be doable.
The power technology after how many years, you know,
they probably just didn't want to rework the code. That's probably,
I mean, maybe this code is spaghetti code and maybe it is really tricky to implement, but man, I wish they did. Like, it's just, it's clearly the biggest missed opportunity. There are other kind of more expected enhancements. There is a turbo mode in battle, where you press a button and you can go to like 2x speed or 3x speed. And it's a relatively simple implementation. You just press a button and everything speeds up, including the battle music, which is a little funny.
That's funny.
It's fine. Like, it's a very simple implementation. I'm not going to say it sucks, but it's, you know, it's just pretty basic. It's good for like summoning
battle transitions. Like, I remember like one of the things that they added in like the PSP versions, like when you can encounter battle, you see like kind of like a battle transition, like the screen fades way or something.
That's there. I saw Cullen generated a meme on this. Did you see that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Basically, like a circle expands from the center of the screen to do the battle transition, and it looks
kind of goofy.
Kind of weird.
Upsetting.
Yeah, more RPGs. Let's shatter the screen. Suikoden, bro, get in me.
There's a. Tell me how the autosave is.
I was just going to get to this. You read my mind. This is the funniest quality of life enhancement I have ever seen in any remaster I've ever played or ever heard about ever. This is so hilarious to me. And I don't think I'm being exaggerating here. The game has an autosave. It added an autosave. It autosaves when you enter a screen with a save point, and that's it. That's when the autosave takes place. When you enter a screen with a save point.
Yeah, that's
it's so
fun. I don't know, man. That's a really weird way to do this. I want to know. I want to know Konami's thinking on this, because it's fascinating to me. I mean, I think. Here's my thinking, because Murayama, the original creator, unfortunately passed away last year, bless his soul. Murayama, throughout interviews throughout the years, always emphasized like the need of like some tension of like, so not rely on like constant save points. He wants you to like make that trek to like the next save, you know. There should be some risk involved of like losing progress.
Aiden did this.
Yeah. So that's my thinking of like why they implemented autosave like this. Of like, hey, they want to respect his original vision and philosophy on that, having that amount of risk to get to the next save point, and like risking, you know, I might die on the next on the trek to the next save point.
It might have been like a technical reason too, like maybe the game code, the way it works is it can only like record progress on certain screens of the map, and like, okay, we can only possibly do an autosave on the screen that already was sort of set up to be a save point. But then at that point, it's just kind of like, what practically does an autosave give you? Like, oh, now if I don't have to actually interact with the save point, I can just walk on by it. And like the most minor convenience possible, I guess.
Yeah, I guess it's like we are just like light speed running this shit. I have no time for save points. At least you have a fallback save, you know? it's a very funny, weird way to like, you hear it the first time, you're like, say that again, and then you're like, there's how it's implemented. It's like, okay.
There are also other minor adjustments to the remaster. Some of these might have been addressed in the PSP version, but for us in the West, they're more or less practically new. Like, for example, the original versions of some of these games had some weird bugs. For example, like in Suikoden 2, you can turn in recipes to your chef, or like farm animals to your farm or plants to your like to your garden. But I know there's people are like, if you look up like old message boards or guides for these games, they're like only turn in one at a time because sometimes a bug happens where like if you turn in 10 recipes at once, maybe only two of them will like reflect and the other eight are just like lost forever. Stuff like that. Or I know there's a couple bugs I read about where like there are recipes dropped from enemies that like if you pick up one of the recipes dropped from an enemy and turn it in, that somehow flags the game where the other recipes will no longer drop. So you're just out of luck. Weird bugs like that. As far as I know, I haven't tested these thoroughly. Those are all gone. And it's just like, do those things really matter? I mean, not really, but it's just kind of like these small annoyances that the original games had. And it's just kind of part of the deal back then was like, if there was a small bug in the game, it was like, it's there and you can't patch it out. It's there. And so those have all been ironed out. A couple of other small things, like there's more character spaces available, like letters in like boxes for like enemy names. For example, zombie slug used to be just a one word name and now it's zombie slug. There's some enemies later in the game that in the original version of the game are called M Knights when they're actually Matilda Knights because they're from Matilda. Small things like that. Like, not a dramatic change, but it's like, hey, if we're making a remaster and we're now not constrained to character limits, like character space limitations, then we can actually name things what they're called. There's actually one of the recruitable characters. I think his name is Long Chan Chan. He's a Chinese like martial artist, and that's his name, Long Chan Chan. In the original English version, his name is LC Chan because they couldn't fit his name in. Things like that. You know, those are all just, you know, small little things that are no longer an issue. Also, there's, I think, more space on the more space in dialogue boxes. So in the original version, when you're clicking through dialogue, there's a lot more line breaks to see it all when a character is talking. And now there's not as many line breaks. Just kind of a visual thing because you don't need to have them anymore. So there's a bunch of small things that I think are improvements to the game. In fact, if you were to ask me which version of Suikoden 2 or 1 should I play, I think unless you have some really specific hangups, I do think this is effectively a replacement for the original PS1 versions. There's very little reason to go back to those. Like, unless you just absolutely hate the new backgrounds in Suikoden 1, if you can put up with all the bugs and whatnot that were in the original versions that have been ironed out, yeah, I guess you can go back to the PS1 version if you want. But, like, moving diagonally, things like that, better UI, I think these new versions, I think, are overall a clear improvement.
Yeah.
So
yeah, I agree with you on that.
And it's not like, and it's also, it's not like I said with the translation earlier, like people to the end of time will argue which translation of Final Fantasy Tactics is better. For better or worse, I guess you don't have that issue here because the translation in Suikoden 2, it's basically the same thing, just polished up. I'm sure there's going to be some individual lines where someone will complain, oh, I like the character of the original, I like the flavor of the original line, and they changed it. I think that's kind of inevitable that someone's going to be upset at some line change somewhere. But overall, it's really faithful.
One big change or addition that they made to this, the quality of life, so we could do specifically, is that event timer.
Oh, yes. I actually
go explain that.
I actually almost didn't see this because it was patched in, I guess, during the review period, so it wasn't there originally.
This is now.
This is for a relatively small event, I assume most people are familiar with Final Fantasy IX, and I assume a good chunk of that group are familiar with the Excalibur 2 quest in that game, where it's basically play through the entirety of the game within like a short period of time, and you can kind of do like this time-gated side quest. Suikoden 2 has one of those as well. It's not as, I guess, notorious because in the original version, you don't actually get anything for doing it. But there's a series of events in Suikoden 2 involving Clive, who is like a gunslinger type character, that you have to basically beat the game in 20 hours to do it. Now, beating the game in 20 hours is certainly doable, but you kind of have to like forego some of the the optional questing, town building.
No gambling.
Totally forget about trying to get rare drops. You don't have time just to waste getting a rare drop or anything. But now you can just turn that off where it's no longer time gated. If you're an achievement hunter, there is an achievement for seeing these scenes. So if you want to get the achievements, but you don't want to rush, just turn off that event timer. Honestly, I don't see why you wouldn't, unless you really get the thrill of like, yes, I beat this game in 20 hours. It's like, just turn it off.
I think it's fine to have it as a top, but some people may want that.
Yeah, I get it. But unless you're like doing it specifically as like a challenge to yourself, I don't know.
I think there's that dumbest thing that video game has implemented, because you're just like, want to enjoy the game and play at your own pace, and now you're forced to rush everything, right? For me, as in like Final Fantasy IX, I can never enjoy that game ever again because I want the Excalibur 2. So I'm always forced to like speedrun this game, right?
Yeah, but I mean, I get why they make it just like a toggle that you can turn off or keep on if you want. But yeah, it's for scenes. You don't actually, unlike the Excalibur 2, you don't actually get anything in the game for doing it. It's just some scenes. It actually does do some world building that I don't remember if it's touched up on in any of the other games. But actually, we can talk about the games themselves now. Suikoden 2 is great. Absolutely great.
I forgot that how quick the game just starts. Like when you click new game on Suikoden 1, it's like you click new game, boom, you're already in the first scene right away, like in the first second.
It just drops you in Gregminster Palace, and you're just like, oh, what am I supposed to do?
Yeah.
You talk to your dad, and then you learn what you're doing. You're basically given a squad.
It really just made me like, I got a little depressed when I thought about games now, because like if you click on a new game on a game now, you have like at least 5 minutes of like setup of like what the game is about.
Oh, like a huge exhibition dump for cutscenes.
Yeah, for me, I just really like that. You know, I feel old now again, but like I just really like that when you press new game, you could play immediately right there and there. Then and there, the game will gradually, you know, fill you in on what's happening, but it doesn't like, you know, it lets you play right away, and then you can kind of learn about it as the game unfolds. I just really appreciate it. Like, it's definitely, they're games of their era, right? Where the script is very short and to the point as well. Yes. When you're interacting with characters, like they don't give you like, you know, five paragraphs of like what's going on, what's the state of the world. They're very down to the point. Here's what you need to do next. Here's where it is. And then if you need like clarification of what to do next, you just talk to them again. It's like, oh yeah, this place is like northeast of here. It's like, okay, got it.
Yeah, there's definitely a certain efficiency in the dialogue in the game, which might be off-putting to some, and in fact, I have seen some people off-put by it, because everything is so quick, especially in the first game. There's a certain economy to the story. Even in things like character death scenes, there are a few deaths in the game, sometimes feel like they just go by really fast. And I guess in modern media, you're so used to, you know, these things being super dramatic, emotional events, which they are, but in this 1990s JRPG, it kind of comes and goes as part of the story, still at a pretty steady clip, even scenes like this. So it's even like anything from exposition to character moments to things like that, they're all pretty economical, which there's a certain charm to it from that era, but it is something that, like I said, starting off this section, I do think it's best to approach these games, whether you're playing them again or for the first time, just like these are 1990s JRPGs with some of the rough patches sanded off. Like it is from the 90s. It's got some of those quirks in terms of writing and mechanics and yes, item management and even some writing stuff. So yes, I think that's the best way to approach these games. It is not Star Ocean 2, whatever that remake was called. It's not Dragon Quest HD2D remake. You know, I even saw, I don't mean to pick on anyone, but I did see someone say, man, they should have just Final Fantasy VII remake this. And I'm No, please.
not to say that I like, it's not like to say
you don't like remake.
It's just like,
that's a huge, I wouldn't want to see a huge endeavor. And that would also be something new.
I don't think the franchise would ever make up money back invested if they were expecting FF7 style.
Yeah. And I would rather, if they're going to, so they've said a lot about Suikoden this week, Konami has, which I'm sure we'll get to. And if they do want to revisit this series, I think this is probably the right approach to take the classics, make them available. I personally prefer the faithfulness that these have with these edges sanded off. I don't need redone sprites. I don't need rewritten dialogue or rewritten stories, or I don't even need like new content. Just make the games playable, sand them off a little bit where they're rough. And if they're going to revitalize this franchise, give me Suikoden 6 or a mobile game.
Yeah.
But give me Suikoden 6. Just do something new.
They're not going to go fast free, okay? I'm sorry, Adam. It's like Star Ocean 3. It never goes fast free.
I'm sorry, you kind of mind broke me a little bit with that FF7 remake comparison, because now I'm now imagining like the Change Bad Ghosts in the original Suikoden. Oh my god. That'd be insane, dude. Yeah, I agree with you. I really like props to Konami and the team working on this. Like the PC port, and it seems like all the console versions seem to be doing well, performing well on this. Like I haven't had any hiccups or anything with the PC version.
Apparently the console versions are 60 frames per second, except for Switch, which is 30 frames per second. Which honestly, for a game like this, as long as it's stable, is probably totally fine. On PC, you actually can get above 60.
Yeah,
if you turn on V-Sync.
Yeah.
For a sprite-based game, like, do you actually get much above 60? Probably not, but you can. It's a relatively, like, it's a relatively bare bones PC port. But I don't. Works. What else? What else would you need?
Yeah. Yeah.
So
there's no shader compilation. There's no stuttering.
Yeah.
It's awesome. You know, like going from this from like Monster Hunter Wilds, like, oh my god, I can play a game smoothly again.
Oh, awesome. I booted up for the first time ever. It took 15 minutes. I counted. I watched several YouTube videos, and it was still compiling freaking shaders.
Anyways. Oh man. Maybe the last thing I want to say about these games, like we've already talked about, I don't know if there's anything, any other component of the remaster that's worth discussing.
Just overall, like for people who've never touched a Suikoden series, like just a very broad like synopsis summary of like overall why should you play Suikoden?
So
play it for Lucas Sprite.
Luca, yeah, Luca Blight. Okay, Suikoden 2, or I should put it this way. Like I said earlier, Suikoden 1 is, I think, kind of prototypical. On its own, I think it's only okay. If you're playing these games for the first time and you're playing Suikoden 1, some people love it. Don't get me wrong. Some people absolutely love it. But if you're playing it and you're like, this kind of feels, you know, so-so, you're only okay on it, maybe doesn't hook you. Or I think the way Cullen put it in his initial impressions was, I don't think this has the sauce. That's a very Cullen thing to say. Suikoden 2 is kind of, I think, where they kind of take that and really run with it. I think the thing about Suikoden 2 that I think is one of the best parts about it is a lot of people, they think of Suikoden as like these kind of like a politically charged like narrative with a lot of, you know, wars and generals and countries at war and things like that, and you know, some discrimination and things like that, where I think Suikoden 2 and other Suikoden games later in the series, really one of their strong suits is actually how the background setting of this politically charged conflict affects the lives of the main protagonists. And Suikoden 2 specifically has an extremely and incredible personal story between the game's main three characters, which are Ryu, Nanami, and Joey. And it, like, this, like, I've seen people say, like, well, Suikoden has 108 characters, you know, how can any of them be well-written? But, like, that's not really the focus of the game. The game's focus, especially 2, is on that main, tight-knit, small cast of, like, Joey, Ryu, and Nanami, and a little bit of Flick, a little bit of Victor, a little bit of Shu and the Silverbergs. But it's, like, the story between the main trio, the ones on the original box art, is so like personal, sentimental, well-written that's the part that people latch onto. When they think about like the memorable moments of Suikoden 2, you're probably thinking about the scene outside of Muse where they're waiting for Joey. You're probably thinking about the scene that happens in Rock Axe Castle. And these are scenes that involve these characters. And Suikoden 2, to put it in Cullen's terms, I think has the sauce. And And it's like, I still moved when I played this game the second time. And so was Paul. I was talking to him as he wrote his review and as I was editing it for him. And I think like that is a lot of the mechanics are also really cool in terms of like, you get so many characters to play with. You have so many different runes that you can slot in and out. In terms of like battle composition stuff, there's a lot of flexibility. In the guides I'm writing, I actually don't even offer that many strategies because there's so many things you can do, and it's just kind of like play around and try something. But I think some of these, the character writing of the main of the main trio and the story hooks that involve them, especially in Suikoden 2, is one of the biggest strengths of the game. I'm also going to pitch, not our review, but I'm going to pitch the review on RPG Fan from Zach Wilkerson, who is also a huge Suikoden fan. And I think he also does a really good job in kind of encapsulating the strengths of these games, including what I just said about the character writing. So go read our review. Paul's review is good. But also, Zach's a friend of mine. Read his, too.
Yeah, definitely. Go check those reviews out. And so many people who play these games, like, there's a good chunk of this, like, you know, people say, like, Suikoden 2 is either one of their favorite RPGs of all time or, like, the best PS1 JRPG ever to them. It's, it has quite a reputation, and I'm really interested to see, like, a newcomer's, like, you know, perspective on it. It's, like, you know, kind of revisit.
No, they get filtered by Suikoden 1. Sorry.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's just like worth. I think Suikoden 1 like is worth playing through, but like we said, it is very much a prototype for like what 2 brings for us. And I hope like you said, Adam, people are willing to like get to 2, whether it's playing through 1 or like going to 2 immediately. It's definitely worth playing on that end. But yeah, that's
Did they have that one thing where you get like a carryover bonus from 1? I remember in the original PlayStation version, you get like some runes if you.
Oh
like,
yeah, so there is a link between Suikoden 1 and Suikoden 2. It is you have a new playable. Basically, a lot of the characters that are in 1 are also playable in 2. And I'm going to have a very minor spoiler here. I'm going to spoil it. Sorry, it's not really a spoiler, but a lot of the characters, if you level up their weapon all the way and tweak it in 1, that's how you strengthen their weapon, is you level it up. It gets a bonus in Suikoden in 2, and this is actually pretty useful for characters like Victor, who you get relatively early, because now you have Victor in your party, and he's got a powered up, you know, weapon in Suikoden in 2. But also, in the original English version of Suikoden in 2, if you imported your Suikoden in 1 save file, the main character in Suikoden 1 is a bonus character in Suikoden 2. However, he's not named properly. There's a glitch there. If you named him, his canon name is Tyr, T-I-R. If you named him Tyr, how it worked in the English version is when he joins you in Suikoden 2, his last name is Mcdohl, M-C-D-O-H-L, but they take the first letter of the name you give him and just slap it over the M. So if you named him Tyr, his name in Suikoden 2 would become Tikdol. It's a glitch. It's not how it's supposed to be. That's fixed. Just kind of another example of a small, annoying, little minor glitch that's no longer there. But yeah, there is a bonus from Suikoden 1 to Suikoden 2. And obviously being a single package, it's relatively easy. Like in the original version, you had to like save at a certain save point to make sure that it's that it would transfer in properly. Here it's like a clear save, pretty standard kind of workings now, where you just like it looks for the clear save and finds it, and you can just load it in. So it's pretty easy.
Cool. So that is Suikoden 1 and 2 HD remaster with a long subtitle after it as part of its official name. Hopefully it does well enough to see other re-releases of the future Suikoden games. I would really, really like to see Suikoden 5 re-released. I am hoping and praying they make it there. I really love Suikoden. Like, for me, it's like Suikoden 2 and Suikoden 5 are my two favorites. I'm sure that's a common opinion.
2 and 5, yeah, those are the ones that most people like. 3 also has its fans because it's so different.
Yeah.
3 is good. It's very slow to start.
I think the only bad one I really dislike is probably 4. I think
you know what's funny about that? You know what's funny about that opinion is 4 is oftentimes considered the weakest one, but it might have the best implementation of the war battles because it's basically Battleship.
Yeah. I think, like, you know, remaster quality of life enhancements would, like, give for a long, long, like, I think more people would are willing to tolerate or appreciate for, you know, given how quality of life implementations are in modern. Because a good chunk of Force criticism is like, man, this is parts. Like the ceiling. Okay. So that's Suikoden 1 and 2 HD Remastered. The what I've been playing this week, I'm about, how many hours in on this? I've been playing the newest release from Haze Light Studios. I forgot what their official name was. Haze Light Interactive or something like that.
I think it's just Haze Light.
Oh, okay. Split Fiction. These are from the developers behind It Takes Two, No Way Out, the original version of Brothers: A Tale of Two Sons. I'm about a little over 7 hours into it, my friend. You can only, just like No Way Out and It Takes Two, this can only be completed and played through with another person playing alongside you, whether online or locally. And it's a pretty awesome evolution of what they started going down with a No Way Out and It Takes Two, where you have like the split screen co-op experience. Sometimes like the split screen will coalesce into like a one singular screen at certain points during gameplay. The setup is it's very much, you know, it's not subtle about its commentary. It's very anti-AI, generative AI with its message. But you're playing these two women, Zoe and Mio, who are both authors trying to, you know, get their ideas published, get their works published. So they're invited into this, like, corporation to maybe sign, like, a publishing deal with them, get paid. And what they didn't sign up for was during their tour around this corporation, there's this machine, and they just call it The Machine, with capital letters on the and machine. Where they can, on the surface, it seems like a good idea, where they get into these like bubbles around this machine, and they can like sort of live out their stories through like a full-on almost VR implementation, but they can live out their story through this machine. But I accidentally, you know, I think Mio is the one. Mio is like, okay, this is weird. I'm out of here. I didn't sign up for this. And during the scuffle between, you know, the people there trying to get her into the machine, she accidentally falls into the into Zoe's bubble. So they're both of their floating bodies are inside this bubble in this machine. So they're starting to, they've now breached each other's like stories. So Zoe is like a fantasy author, you know, very typical fantasy, dragons, knights, castles. Mio is a science fiction author, so very futuristic environments, robots, cyberpunk, flying cars, etc. Very futuristic settings.
This is practically the premise of the game and the title, right? And like the exactly. Art, so
exactly, there's nothing really, you know, spoilery about that. Obviously, you know, it's very easy to know or to predict where the story goes in terms of like what the machine is, and like, you know, maybe it's not, this is kind of, you know, more devious than it sounds on the surface, but you know, I won't spoil that if people want to go through and experience it for themselves. But you're essentially this game, I guess, but one of my other friends sums it up well, where like this game feels like it turns into a completely different game every 8 minutes, because you're constantly traversing different environments, different worlds, sometimes different genres, flip-flopping between different fantasy worlds and different science fiction worlds, and like different subgenres of those, you know, of those two genres, like overall big genres. So like at one point, you know, like during the fantasy section, like you gain shape-shifting abilities. So my character could turn into a monkey and like a little sea otter. That had different specialties. While my friend, their character, could turn into a fairy, and this Groot, Marvel Groot, like tree man, style creature. They had like different functions and abilities to go traverse to the level. And sometimes you would need to, or often you would need to work together to make different routes for the other person to traverse, so they can go to the next spot where they have to make another route for you, to traverse, and so forth. And you'll gain like different temporary abilities along the way. So, but like after shapeshifting, you know, you might go to a science fiction world and you're like cyber ninjas. So I have like a laser sword, while my friend has a laser whip. I have gravity shifting abilities where I can go on platforms and like walk on like different, like when I gravity shift to like a certain spot, maybe the wall is not my floor, etc.
So this isn't like really this isn't really super relevant to our audience, yeah. But yeah. Have any of you read Patrick Klepek's write up on this?
Patrick Klepek's. I saw like a brief summary of like he was playing with his 8-year old.
So his Crossplay blog is basically like parenting in video games, and he was writing about his co-op experience playing with his 8-year old daughter. First of all, it's kind of adorable hearing his daughter like jump dash, like trying to figure out like the patterns of the game. Right. But in his write up, he was saying stuff like, "This is a great game to play, like with, you know, young children or maybe people who don't play games as much, because like how the co-op works is like there are many puzzles where as long as one person surpasses it, both people can surpass it. So it's not like maybe the weaker player is going to be dragging down the more veteran player or anything like that. The game is pretty lenient in basically allowing you to progress as long as one person like can play through it. I don't know all, of course, the specifics, but his write-up was basically, while he had some maybe criticism on some of like the accessibility stuff, he said it was like just a really great experience for something like that, you know, playing with someone like an 8-year-old.
Absolutely, yeah. So, yeah, if you have like want to play someone like, you know, a new game with your child, you know, this is definitely this is very flashy too. It keeps you entertained, and there's not any like character progression abilities or persistence systems that like you have to worry about. It's purely like an action game, and there's not even collectibles in it. The only optional stuff are like these side stories, side story portals that are pretty like, you know, well signaled, like, hey, there's a side story here, like you get like a pulse around them that you can see off from a distance. And then the neat thing about this is like, let's say the main storyline is you're traversing through the science fiction world. Well, all the side stories that you encounter in this level are all fantasy worlds. So it flip-flops between like, hey, if you're like in this science fiction world, all the side stories are going to go to the ideas, back to the ideas of like the other author. So you can go like take a brief break for the science fiction section and go briefly for like, you know, 3 to 5 minutes in this fantasy themed entire like new space, new world. It's just like very much traversing through it, experiencing what it has. Like an example side story is like on the fantasy realm is like, it's basically it's a really creative like platforming level where you're traversing through giants that are basically doing circus moves. So the level is pretty much, hey, you're platforming across like different parts of giants, whether it's like their fingers or running along their legs, trying to get to the next platforms. And as you're traversing through them, there are other giants doing circus moves in the background as the gradually forming like your next platform to traverse across. You know, and it's like really, it's always varied. You're never like experiencing like the same thing twice. For an example, a side story on like the science fiction themed is like, it's like almost like a Smash TV sort of setup. And the main gimmick there is like, you have a bomb that's a hot potato. So you can only hold the bomb for a few seconds before you have to pass it to the other person. And the person has to manually catch it.
Happens they don't for catch it
to like not explode.
Oh,
then the bomb explodes. Yeah, yeah. So you basically have to kind of throw it. And you be wary. Hold it for a few seconds to throw it back. Hold it for a few seconds, throw it back, and always kind of keeping communicating with your teammate. Like, hey, you know, like I gotta throw it to you. So yeah, be ready to catch it. And it's very much like the whole game is like an amusement park ride that never lets up. It's always, you're always doing something. There are some down times, but like just to give you a breather. But it's constantly always switching it up. It's a blast. I recommend it for, you know, pretty much anyone who just wants like a really fun co-op game to play with someone else. And it's
It's a delight. The main criticisms I've heard about this game, which to me aren't too surprising, is that, and again, this I haven't played the game. You can tell me what you think. But I've just heard a couple people talk about how, like, they set up these characters to kind of be like opposites of each other, and it feels a little bit contrived in terms of like these characters, you know. And I assume just starting out, they're opposite, they bicker a bit, and I assume by the end they're, you know, more cooperative and whatnot. But I heard some criticisms about how that writing takes place, despite the game being fun. But again, that's also, I also feel like that's also maybe not too unexpected that that's the avenue they would go. But
yeah, I mean, like it's very typical where, like, you know, like opposites, they did, like, you know, the like Mio is a bit more reserved and to herself, while Zoe is a bit more open, and you know, they come from different backgrounds, you know, like Mio's from the city, Zoe's from the country, and they have different, you know, beliefs on that front, on like what they prefer. Obviously, as they work together, they start understanding and learning more about each other, being more open to one another, and like learning about each other's backgrounds, and like, you know, what led them to become authors, why did they participate in this publishing deal, you know, like, you know, you'll get like Mio's family problems, for example, you go through the game. But I would say, like, just the general dialogue is like probably the weakest part of this game, where it's very tongue-in-cheek, right? Like, for example, like there's like this hammer enemy, and they have, it has like very, there's a lot of puns in this game, so like a lot of the hammers lies is like about smashing and pounding, and they're getting all the puns around that, and the game that like is pretty, not always pun heavy, but there's definitely certain sections where like they're making a lot of puns here. Like there was one earlier where there's a side story that involves space and managing like oxygen, for example. You're platforming as oxygen is running out, and then like there's a station where like you know, you can refill oxygen, and then Joey or Zoe remarks after your first oxygen refill was a breath of fresh air, you know, just like, you know, tongue-in-cheek lines like that are corny, but it's like inoffensive, where it's like, ugh, but at the same time it's like, it's whatever, you know, it's not meant to have like super engaging or thrilling dialogue, like that's sort of like simple gameplay that it presents, you know. It's supposed to be a very family friendly game. There are definitely deep introspective moments to it, but it never becomes like too dark. Obviously, it has to be. They're deliberately trying to make it family friendly too.
Right.
You know, so having some of those corny lines will work better on younger audiences than like us, who are old and decrepit and are, you know, on death's door.
Just on that note, just talking about Patrick Klepek's blog again, or was it him or someone else? I forget, but apparently, like, someone's, it might have been him. He got his 4-year-old daughter to say the word shit. So,
oh,
it's just
no.
Kind of funny.
But yeah, it's, you know, I don't want to detail too much about, like, you know, what else in the, like, what's in the game. Obviously, it's like, it's a very set piece heavy game, and having those, seeing those moments for the first time is, like, part of the charm of that, but they're very clever, just all around. Like the art style is constantly transforming and shifting. Don't ever get too comfortable about like how the game plays like any given moment, because it's always willing to change it up, you know, different perspectives, where at the, like at some point it might like just turn to like a 2D side scroller, for example, or in the next part there might be a shmup section, or there might be another, it's like a create your own adventure, you know, sort of.
Yeah, I remember It Takes Two was very, very similar to that. And yeah. I remember my favorite part of that game was when it's like, hey, it's a single screen now. One of the players has to control this plane while the other person is doing a fighting game match against this squirrel on top.
Yeah, I remember that. Yes. Yeah, that's it's a delight. Like, I'm really glad that like the studio has kind of found like their own unique spin in the industry, like delivering experiences that, like, you know, no other modern studio is doing. It's just like, hey, more power to them. That this is awesome. They really knocked it out of the park once again at this one. So
the joke I said is that as much as like Joseph Ferris sounds like he's cocky, I don't I guess he's allowed to be, considering like Hazelight's output over the last like decade.
Yeah, I mean, like, yeah, it seems like, you know, the way that, like, you know, he, like, runs his team is, like, it's, like, it seems healthy and seems great, you know, like, hopefully, like, things are working out over there. It seems like this team's constantly, like, just doing great stuff now, and they're already working on their next game, so see how that, what form that'll take in the next few years as they continue to work on it. So yeah, good on them, really, really great on them. Also on the implementation of like the friends pass here, like they did it with the It Takes Two, where you only need one copy. If you're playing with another person, obviously you have to play with another person, but you only need one copy between both of you. Like one person buys it, the other person downloads the friends pass, and then that person just invites the person to the friends pass over to their game. Then you can play together. So like it's like a 2-for-1 or yeah, 1-for-2 deal on that front, and it doesn't you don't have to interact with the EA app anymore. Like you can do everything through Steam now, so it's just like just send off a Steam invite. You never have to like sign in through the EA app whatsoever to play, which is, you know, great. You know, I the less services I have to log into to play my game, the better.
Yep.
That's cool. So yeah, Split Fiction, definitely, if you're waiting for a sale or whether you're curious, like, you know, just pick it up whenever you can.
The initial reception to this game, both critically and whatever metrics we have access to, all look really good.
Yeah. I mean, like, It Takes Two sold, like, what, 20 like
million?
1 million? I think the most recent number is, like, 22 million copies sold, which is insane.
That's crazy. Wow, that's a lot. That's a lot.
Yeah, so if you're wondering why Hazelight is allowed to do whatever they want, their games are critically and commercially the most successful stuff that EA publishes.
Well, that's Split Fiction. James, by the way, Chow, I had to step out. He had some real life stuff to do. So
happy birthday, Chow.
Yeah, that's right. Chow's birthday recently passed this week. Happy birthday, Chow. Belated birthday. He had to step out for the rest of the podcast, but we thank him for joining us during this weekend talk. James, you've been dipping back into FRU and FF14. You've been working at this. Well, not dipping back into, but you've been working at it as you've been doing other stuff.
Yeah, so I've talked about in the past how I'm a pretty avid 14 raider. When Dawn Trail came out, I did the first Savage Raid tier week one, so I cleared it week one before the reset, and I decided, hey, let me do when Dawn Trail first came out, I wasn't sure if I was gonna do Futures Rewritten Ultimate, which was the new Ultimate Raid, because some background, back when Endwalker was the thing, I almost cleared Dragon Song Reprise, the first Endwalker Ultimate on content. I didn't quite get there. I got to the Enrage for phase 6, so the penultimate phase, and then for any ultimate raid, the final phase is basically just a nerf check. It's not really super like mechanically dense. It's just once you get here, it's the victory lap. You just need to lock in. So because of that, there was like some sour feelings about that whole situation, because it's like I know I could have cleared DSR if I had spent just a little more time on it. Just I kind of got burnt out, and there was all sorts of other things. To be blunt, at the time, my first time doing Savage Raids in 14 was that Savage Raid tier before DSR came out. So I was pretty new to high-end content in 14, and I think that's part of the reason why I did struggle a bit. But I've done way more raid tiers now. I've done 3 raid tiers instead of 1. Obviously, even though I didn't clear DSR, that meant that I had plenty of ultimate raiding experience. So when Futures Rewritten came out, I was like, let's see if I can clear it on Party Finder. So and Party Finder is like the kind of public in-game. You make a party, you put a listing, you kind of put what you want in the party, what strats you're using, that sort of thing. And for a couple of months, that's how I was doing Futures Rewritten. I was doing it on Party Finder, and I was also subbing in for statics on like some Discords where people would be like, here's temporary recruitment. We need like somebody that's like an off tank or whatever role they're looking for to fill because one of our people is unable to come. And really, most of my prog was in those groups because they were generally probably a little bit better because there's communication and whatnot. And then, like, early January, I ended up finding a group randomly on Party Finder, had, like, a really good session with some folks. And afterwards, because they kind of passed the vibe check, I asked, hey, are you guys looking for an off tank? And they were. And for the last 2 months, I've been raiding with them. And earlier this week, we got our clear.
Hey, congratulations.
Yeah, and if you're into MMO raiding, you know how much of a commitment this can be, especially for like higher end difficulty. Ultimate raids in 14 are the hardest difficult, like the hardest content in the game. It's the content that is going to stress your knowledge of how the game's mechanics work, how your jobs work, and also like it forces your party to work together in a way that no other content does. In order to even do Futures Rewritten, you need to have cleared the, as of right now, current Savage Raid tier. Give it a month, that's no longer going to be the current tier, but which is why I'm kind of glad I really cleared it now, so I have a couple weeks break before I have to get ready for the next Savage tier. But yeah, it's a commitment, I think. So with Dawntrone, I guess technically it started with Late Endwalker. There's this website that people have made called Tomestone. And it used to be that the only resource you had for raiding to check how you've been doing was FF logs, where most people that raid in 14, especially in the West, will log their actions and they'll upload them so that they can see how they're doing DPS wise and mechanically compared to other people using the same roles, which is, no matter what you might say about like modding in 14, I definitely I've legitimately never modded 14 myself, but when it comes to high-end raiding, it's kind of like a necessary evil. A Tomestone is like an expansion on FF logs where it takes the logs that have been uploaded and kind of is a better front end to see it. And also, especially for ultimate raids, it for stuff that gets uploaded that aren't clear logs, they'll still be able to tell you how far you've gotten into a fight. Which is especially useful when you're in Party Finder, because then if you join a group that's saying, hey, I'm on this mechanic, you can trust but verify they're on that mechanic and not waste your time.
Okay, yeah, that's pretty handy.
Yeah, people can definitely argue that maybe it's a bit toxic, but on the flip side, people lying about their prog point to try and get a free lunch is also toxic.
It's one of those things, like, it's the hardest content of the game. You, like, everyone has to pull their weight. So you, at some point, you have to establish a baseline of trust with each other pretty quickly. You can't just always be starting from zero every time. Having some verifiable info. It makes sense there. Like, yeah. Because it's content that, like, allows for virtually no mistakes.
Yeah, and to put in perspective, like, my experience, like, finally clearing the raid after several months, that's the norm. Like, most people, it takes them like 3 months to clear an ultimate raid. And considering the fact that if you're doing an ultimate raid, chances are you're raiding at least like 12 hours a week. That's, yeah, if you're doing an ultimate raid, chances are, unless you're like the super upper echelon of raiders and you're going for like world first, you're going to clear the ultimate raid after over 100 hours in that fight. For a single fight.
Mm-hmm.
It is a commitment, but it is a lot of fun.
Yeah.
And despite the fact that it took me over 150 hours to get the clear, I'm happy I did it. And especially since there was some of that, like, not really resentment, but like regret that I never managed to do DSR on content. Even being able to do through on content has been like, well, at least I was able to do it now. And now it's like, okay, I can do this, and I've, you know what I mean.
Yeah, I mean, congrats, and till the next one, till the next.
Yeah, I'm probably gonna, like, whenever new 14 content drops, I usually write up some thoughts on it, and I'm definitely gonna do something on Fru now that I've cleared it, but it's, I wonder how many people are gonna even be able to resonate with that. I remember when I did that, impressions on the chaotic raid. Like, one of the comments we got was like, well, I'm glad that raiders are happy, at least. Very obviously somebody that isn't a raider and isn't happy with the state of Tundra.
Well, I mean that's not the raider's fault. That's the kind of the developers, like, you know, they make their choices.
And you know? One thing I've been pretty consistent about is that, like, Dawn Trail's, like, content roadmap has been a little bit lopsided. As a raider, I've been very happy because there's always been something for me to do. But if I wasn't a raider, I would definitely,
Okay, well, that's cool. Thank you for sharing your experience with your clear of Futures Rewritten Ultimate for FF14. That's tricky. When do you guys expect, like, a new content drop for that game?
We're expecting 7.2 at the end of the month. The live letter, the final live letter for 7.2 is actually going to be next week on the 14th.
Okay.
And the expectation is that the patch will drop on the 25th, probably. And usually, as they've done in the last couple of Savage tiers, we're expecting that the Savage tier will unlock a week after the patch. So it'll give people a week to do the normal mode. It'll give people a week to prepare for the Savage Raid. Because it used to be before Endwalker that the Savage Raid tier would unlock at the same time as normal mode, which meant that it was a mad dash to get through the normal mode raids within an hour and then get into Savage. And then just, it's like, no breaking, no chance to, like, even, like, rest and do the MSQ before it's time to do the Savage Raid. And pretty much the entire player base is on the same page that the way that they've done it since Endwalker is a lot more sustainable, and it's a lot more healthy in the sense that even if you're a raider, it lets you do the other things in the patch first so that you don't have to immediately just focus on raiding. Because if you are a raider, that's the number one thing you care about. That's the number one thing that you want to do, especially if you're like me and you want and you try to clear the tier week one. Every little moment counts.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you, James, for that. As Adam and I mentioned earlier, on the site we have a review for the Suikoden 1 and 2 HD remaster, plus there are some guides up and Steam Deck impressions from Mikhail. Seems to be, you know, obviously running pretty well on Steam Deck. You would expect so for those caliber of games. So if you want to play them on the go, seems like a good option. Mikhail also put up Steam Deck impressions for Rise of the Ronin because it is about to come out fairly soon for PC. I forgot the exact release date on the PC port of that, but in the next few days. He got a chance to check out the PC port's graphics options and how it runs on the Steam Deck and ROG Ally. Unfortunately, on Steam Deck, he said right away, it's not a great experience on Steam Deck, but it was sort of expected because it's a high-fidelity open-world game and, you know, definitely doesn't play to the strengths of Steam Deck specs. On ROG Ally, it's a better experience there. It's able to hit 60 FPS and hold 1080p with performance upscaling. So if you're looking to play it on the go, Steam Deck, possible, but not favorable. On ROG Ally, better. But they're for Mikhail, I don't know if we're expecting patches down the line, but Mikhail did experience, like, you know, some crashing issues on the Steam Deck. We got a new preview from Scott, who actually got a chance to play, and you too, James, I believe, a chance to play like a demo preview for the upcoming Clair Obscur Expedition 33 by Sandfall Interactive. This was first showcased, I believe, at like an Xbox event.
Yes, it was Xbox's like E3 style, not E3 anymore, but you know what I mean, like the summer event where it was like one of their announcements, I believe, then. I did get a chance to play a bit of it. I didn't complete the demo build, which I'm pretty sure the implication is that this build is going to be released publicly eventually, because people that did finish it said that there was like a pre-order now thing at the end of the demo, and it's like you're not gonna do that for people that you pre like seeded to give this.
I believe like on the day of this embargo, like on that day, I think some content creators were allowed to stream the it as well for a brief amount of a time. So, So I'm hoping this goes public before its release date on April 24th. Scott was very positive on it. Was really, really impressed by the.
I completely agree with him. Like what I played of it, I didn't complete the whole demo because basically what happened is since I knew I wasn't doing the preview because we did get the spare key, I was like, I'll play a little bit just to see how I feel about it. And then I put about an hour and a half into it and I was like, okay.
You're sold. I'm sold. You'll play the full game.
Yeah, that's exactly what happened.
That's great. I mean, yeah, that's definitely one of the more like RPGs that has a head turner ever since its debut, high budget. Western developed. Japanese RPG style.
I feel like when it was revealed, a lot of people were on the same page where it was like they saw the game. It's like this art style is neat. This seems like a neat vibe, but I'm not sure how much jank combat I'm gonna be willing to deal with to play this, because until they showed the combat, most people were assuming there was like an action RPG or an action game, because like you look. In a vacuum, you look at what Expedition 33 looks like, and for lack of a better term, then the one word that springs to mind is Eurojank. And maybe that's a bit derivative or derogatory, but like, can't blame people for making that assumption.
It's definitely like, you know, we've seen a lot of like other examples in the past, so I don't fault
anyone. But as soon as they showed the gameplay, it's like, oh, it's turn-based. Now you have my attention. Anyways,
you don't really see that a lot, like JRPG inspired turn based RPGs, but like a Western aesthetic or Western developer. Like I think of like the Lord of the Rings, the Third Age on PlayStation 2. It's like that's really cool that like you have basically like a FF10, but it's a Lord of the Rings skinned FF10 battle system.
It's actually very funny how blatant it is. The Lord of the Rings one.
Yeah.
But it's like, it's cool to see. It's like, hey, that's neat. I like FF10 and I like Lord of the Rings. So.
But I think in this case, like the fact that this is like a new studio with no pedigree, I think that's both simultaneously kind of that's what makes it interesting, but also, you know, understandably so, people were hesitant, like, well, we have nothing to go on here. Like, are these guys any good or not in terms of developing this game? So
yeah, meanwhile, and it's not even just Scott, like as far as I can tell, pretty much everyone else that got access to the preview build, like, or at least most of the people were like on the same page where it's like, yeah, this fucking rules. So it definitely seems like this is going to be something to keep, well, not just to keep an eye out for. Like, I mean, it's going to be on Is it going to be on Game Pass? I'm pretty sure it's going to be on Game Pass. So if because of like everything was at that Xbox showcase.
Yes, it's Game Pass. Yes, it is.
Yeah. But yeah, if you're listening to this podcast, you should definitely check this out when it drops.
I actually think this also releases at a pretty good time in terms of April. I know there's a few other games in April, like The 100 Line and a few other things, but it's not as crazy as like March or February. So
yeah.
Yeah, hopefully they get the public demo out before that release date. Like it seems like there definitely are, but like they haven't given us any real details yet on like if it's gonna come be a public demo and when that's gonna hit. So hopefully they definitely, it is a good idea to do that. So yeah, I'm looking forward to getting my hands on the full game, and it's cool to see the like early impressions from like of. Like from a lot of early access people is, hey, this is turning out to be something special. Best of luck, and I can't wait to play it.
Yep.
We also have some reviews up. One from Junior, played through Everhood 2, gave it a pretty high score, but it's an interesting review because it's one of those reviews. Like, I don't know if this game is for me, but I appreciate a lot of what it's doing.
It's actually Junior's review is actually. I actually like how he approached it, or what he basically boiled it down to is, I don't know if I understand this game, but I made me feel something. And in fact, I actually have read similar sentiments about this game. I have not played Everhood 1. I know it's generally well-liked, but I've heard Everhood 2. I've heard a lot of people say like the story makes no sense or it's nonsense or whatever. But yeah, basically Junior's approach was that the game kind of affected him, but he's not sure he fully understood it, and he admits that in his review. Like, this game is bizarre and weird, and touches on pretty deep things at times, but also very not deep things.
It's very abstract, and I think that's, you know, it's appreciated in a world where, like, there's less abstract things in games. Like, it's very straightforward for most games these days. Well, this one's like, hey, you can understand there's a depth to it, but you have to, like, kind of process and think about it a little bit more of, like, what did I just witness?
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, definitely go read that. I believe you don't have to play the first Everhood to get into Everhood 2.
I think the first game is only, like, 7 hours long or something.
Okay. So,
but they're not long games, but it seems like it's kind of a really interesting, you know, a game like unlike most others.
Yeah. Nathan published his review on Phantom Brave the Lost Hero, which I released on consoles in late January, just at the tail end of it. We still don't know when it's going to release for PC yet. We know it's coming to PC, but we just don't have a date yet on that. Nathan was pretty, like, he enjoyed Phantom Brave, but there's definitely some, you know, key flaws. Like, it's definitely not, like, a super great game in terms of, like...
He also specifically played the Switch version, and yeah. I don't know if you remember when this game showed up in the Nintendo Direct. Like... Yeah. I think we talked about it on this podcast. Like, they showed, like, you know, a 20-second clip on Nintendo Direct, and it was like, felt like single-digit frame for frames. Like, oh wow, this does not look like it's running well at all. And apparently, it does not. He ran into a lot of issues on the Switch version.
Yeah, I remember when I played it at Anime Expo. I specifically played the PS5 version, which ran great, but it did have, like, back then, which again, it was well before it came out, so it doesn't matter. But there was, like, one crash, but. When I played a little bit more of the game at TGS, I did get a chance to check out the Switch version, and the performance wasn't good. It was better than the footage from the Nintendo Direct, at least in what I played, but it's definitely one of those cases where I understand why they have to get these games on Switch, especially because of the Japanese market, even if it isn't really doing much to help how these games are selling in Japan. I am so worried for NS, but... It's not great.
It's okay. I'm sure NIS is really looking forward to the Switch 2 presentation.
Well, so. NIS has some and has a live stream coming up here.
That's true. Yeah, they do have I forgot what it's basically upcoming titles or untitled new titles presentation sometime next week. Let's see what they have. There's some interesting wording around like it because as reported by Gamatsu. They say this includes quote-unquote long-awaited sequels and quote-unquote completely new titles. Well, the S at the both of them is like in parentheses, so it could be one or it could be multiple of those. So, I don't know.
Apparently the voice actors, the Japanese voice actors, one of them is like, I guess they're in Disgaea 4 and the Awakened Fate Ultimatum. We're gonna get another one of those Awakened Fate games. Everyone was looking forward to this.
Yeah.
I barely remember those exist.
Me too.
There's like the Guided Fate Paradox and like the Awakened Fate or something like that. I don't know.
Did they ever get released on PC or did it
I don't think so. I think they're PlayStation 3 or whatever.
Yeah.
Long awaited sequel. What NIS game, NIS game have you been long awaiting a sequel for?
I don't know.
It's this year will be the 5th year anniversary of Labyrinth of Gloria, so maybe they're making the next entry in the series.
I was thinking something older like La Pucelle.
So, oh, okay. Okay.
I don't know.
Okay, so moving on to the main news and topics this week, as I said earlier, we had a big Suikoden event stream or video pop up this week. They announced a lot of things with Suikoden. First event over obviously, the 1 and 2 HD remaster that it was releasing this week, they showed off, you know, that you could turn off the event timer. Before we get to the big one, they're making an anime adaptation of Suikoden 2. They're calling it Suikoden the Anime. And they only released like a few, you know, teasers, footage of like what it's going to look like. It's like a brand new internal animation studio. That's not to say that the staff has never worked on anime before. Maybe individually they have, but together as a team, this will be their first anime production, so they're calling it Suikoden the anime, and it is based off Suikoden 2, which is probably the.
I mean, that seems
choice.
Like that seems like yeah. If you were going to make an anime, that's what you would make it of.
Yes, they're also adapting the first Suikoden 1, as a stage play in Japan. There's tons of stage plays adaptations in Japan, so that's kind of the norm there, which is cool. They have a lot more merchandising that they announced, like, you know, upcoming manga, and then, like, I think it was like a symphonic orchestra release or of some sorts. So a lot of new Suikoden merchandise coming. But the big announcement there that they spent a lot of time on was they announced a brand new Suikoden game called Suikoden Star Leap, coming to iOS and Android. Yes, there is gacha. Yes, there is, like, you know, going to be events, probably, like, you know, FOMO events, limited time events. But there's kind of a weird one, because the way that they're positioning this as is, like, this is going to be technically part of the mainline Suikoden games. This Star Leap mobile game takes place before the events of Suikoden 1 and a bit after Suikoden 5. And for people who don't know, Suikoden 5 does take place, is a prequel to the entire series. It does take place.
I think 4 takes place before 5. I think 4 is the earliest.
I thought 5 was the earliest.
Maybe both before 1. I just forget which one is first.
Yeah, I thought 5 was the first one. But you could be right. So that's how they're positioning it as, and they said that all the 108 Stars of Destiny, which is like the people that you recruit in all the Suikoden games, they're called the Stars of Destiny. They're saying that they're all going to be able to be recruited for free. You won't have to gacha for them. And all of them are going to be playable in battle. Not to say that all they're all going to be amazing in battle, but they're saying they're all going to be. There's no non-combatant exclusive Star of Destiny in this game. And the gacha is there for, like, if people want to roll for, like, characters that have shown up in other Suikoden games, there's going to be banners for them. So, like, hey, Joey for Suikoden 2, you love Joey? Well, here you go. Here's the Joey banner, and this is the gacha game. You're gonna have, like, seasonal versions of those characters. So you're gonna have, like, maybe Summer Joey and Santa Joey and Wedding Dress Joey. What else? You know, just whatever. And another nugget that I saw that was reported by Bloomberg when they interviewed one of the key staff at Konami. Pushing Suikoden again, is that there's also going to be items that, like, item boosters that you can pay real money for if you want to speed up, like, the process of building stuff in your base, because in Suikoden games you usually have, like, a central base for all your recruitable characters reside in. So, like, there's going to be some sort of base building management aspect in this game that'll rely on real-time timers till they're fully built. And I guess you can use boosters, whether the game gives it out some out for free, but you can purchase more.
Close enough. Money. Welcome back, Ni No Kuni 2 Revenant Kingdom.
Dragalia Lost also had this as well. And, you know, it's not a new thing for gacha games, but this, you know, there's that nugget of info I saw in the Bloomberg article for this game. So, you know, it's Suikoden is back, Adam.
So my main takeaway on this is that I didn't play any of the Suikoden games at launch. I didn't get to any of them. Like, the Suikoden 5 released in 2006. I probably didn't get to it until, like, the 2010 sometime. I played every Suikoden game late. When Suikoden 1 and 2 came out on PSN, I played them there. And then the other 3 or 4, Tactics and Tear Crisis, I just bought copies and played them, and they were complete, intact experiences. And, like, gacha games, you can't do that. I'm not a fan of gacha games because I don't want to play on a schedule. I don't want to schedule my playtime around banners and events and FOMO. Like, if I wait to play Suikoden Starlink or whatever this is called, is it even going to exist in 10 years or 5 years? So, I don't know.
Yeah, that's the kind of weird thing about this. So, it did get announced for both Japan and the West. There's like an English, you know, there's an English description, English page, English trailer for this game. So, I assume this will be like a worldwide simultaneous version of the game. So like, it's not like if one sinks, the other one survives. It might be like, hey, if they're gonna shut this down, it's probably gonna be all at once. I don't think it's gonna be like a Atelier Resliriana situation where the Japanese release came first and then like 6 months to a year later the global version came out, but then they just sunk global version because that wasn't working out for them. So I assume it's gonna be like Dragalia Lost, where like that's the only one I can think of in recent memory, right? That has that sort of model. I don't know what to really expect. The art style for this is very reminiscent of like the first two games. It is that pixel art style, not 3D models, like they're not like the later Suikoden games. They announced like the first, or showed out the first handful of characters, you know, with a hero that you can probably rename. And then sort of the significant characters around that. But they didn't really show off too much of the game outside of like these character introductions. And there is some sort of like war mode, like in the previous games that this has. This carries on like a similar battle system in the first two games, where you have your six characters, three in the front, three in the back row, isometric view style. So it's very much in the style of the first two games and really trying to appeal to that. And you know, it's one of those things where I get it, right? They're trying to appeal to a new audience, and the way to kind of reach that modern audience, younger audience these days, is like through free-to-play model, which I get. You know, I just don't know if this game has the appeal, because people, I feel like modern younger audiences these days, the pixel art of this doesn't really speak to them. They want like miHoYo style, full-on 3D model anime cel shading, like they see in Genshin and Honkai Star Rail and Zenless Zone Zero. I don't know if that, like, if a younger person looks at this and says, "Man, I can't wait to play this game," you know, because I feel like younger audiences have been conditioned to just really embrace that full-on 3D anime art style.
And even still, like, the Atelier mobile game, is that still up in Japan? It's just the...
Yes.
Yeah. So, but the global version's gone. Yes. So, and that's not, you know... I know that's maybe... I have no idea how well it's doing in Japan. But, like, that's not pixel art, and that seems to be... That definitely didn't work in the West. So, I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, that was very, you know... Space.
And Atelier is more relevant, modern than Suikoden is. So...
Right. I'm just like, I don't know who... I don't know if this will find like that younger audience it wants. I want to hope, like, I want it to be a great game. Obviously, it's just like, I don't know what the audience is for this game. I feel like the audience for this game is like 35 to 40 year old people who remember Suikoden, and those people are attached to those mainline console games. They're not necessarily going to be like jumping, skipping up and down for like, yes, a free-to-play game with in-game microtransactions instead of a mainline console game.
In terms of like timeline placement too, there hasn't been any movement on Suikoden timeline in like 20 years, so it doesn't really matter. But like, I feel like centering it right before Suikoden 1 again is also not that interesting, because they've kind of already have done that.
Yeah.
They already expanded, like Suikoden 5 already kind of leads into 1. Sort of. So, and there's other stuff around the time too, like Suikoden Gaiden, which takes place right after 1. And so it's just kind of like, I don't know how interesting that is in terms of, ooh, we get more context about the world at that time. I don't know.
Yeah. And it's like one of those things where they have to like play by those like time restricted rules now, where like I don't know how you really like, obviously I could be wrong, but I just don't know how you like make this game interesting in the sense that, like, if you lead too much on the timeline of both of those games, right? Like, if you do something that affects like one of those games, you upset already that core fan base that you're trying to maybe appeal to. For people who are like nostalgic for the series, like, hey, I'll give this a shot. And then like if you do something that upsets them, then
like, risk. This also kind of feels like that sort of puzzle box canon stuff that I don't really care for. Right. I bet Josh, aren't you super curious to know what George Prime was doing between Suikoden 5 and Suikoden 2? Like, he had to be doing something. What was he doing? Maybe this game can enlighten us about what he was doing in that time.
It does have that effect as well, where yes, it'll feel like the need to over-explain things, like, you know, say what this character was up to during that time, finally illuminate that long-standing mystery that no one really, well, you know? I
want to see what was Luca Blight like as a child.
Young Luca. Yeah, I can't wait for the Lumentine Luca Blight event, and then the Luca Blight banner.
Great. We need to get a new character render of young Luca. You don't know Luca Blight.
Yeah, he kicked a puppy when he was 5.
He probably broke the puppy's neck.
So we'll see. I mean, this is the they're saying that right away, like, the story premise of this game is about the Rune of Change, which is one of the 27 true runes. And it's centering on the Scarlet Moon Empire.
Which is the empire from the first game.
So yeah, well, or it's sorry, it begins just east of the Scarlet Moon Empire.
Okay. Yeah, they use that as the reference point because it's basically like the first game takes place in the Scarlet Moon Empire. The second game takes place, I think, just south of it or just north of it in the Highlands. So yeah, there's a world that's already been established, and they're like, okay, where does this take place? East of it. Okay.
You guys are stupid. I will give this game a shot, but I know I'm gonna get mad.
The most generous, the most optimistic I can be is if this game happens to do well enough where the tail can wag the dog and they can use it to justify a proper release of a new Suikoden, then I will accept it. So the
fake Grand Order effect.
Sure.
Where it's just basically so successful that they're finally localizing all the previous stuff plus making new stuff.
Yeah, sure. I forget where it was, but there was some interview where they said they want Suikoden to compete again on like the AAA stage, and like, baby steps here. Like, it hasn't competed in 2 decades.
I think in the Bloomberg interview there too, like, one of the people behind this was like, yeah, I really hope like Suikoden like gets like a holiday, like a Hollywood movie. It's like, man, all right, I guess.
Like, let's slow down. How about we see how this remaster does? You do the mobile game, consider remastering Suikoden 3 first, and then let's go from there.
And it's always the mobile gacha gambit is always a little, it gets me a little bit anxious because I feel like people always take, or the companies always take the wrong lessons from this when they take the mobile game gacha gambit of like, if it does well, sweet, it's popular, let's milk it, only let's milk this only thing for the next 5 years because it's so popular. And then the flip side is like, okay, this thing does poorly, we have to announce an end of service within the first year of it. That means that no one cares about Suikoden anymore. Our plans to revive this IP has failed. Time to ditch it for another 40 years, you know? It's like, how about the other, you know, Suikoden things that, you know, there are more than 2 games in Suikoden that, you know, you can re-release.
This is completely unrelated, but a friend of mine shared, I think, Sensor Tower data for the top 50 performing mobile games in Japan. You know what was not on there? Tribe Nine. Tribe Nine has, from what I can tell, has like cratered. Like, it has not.
I have been following the saga of Tribe Nine, and it is a fascinating saga because it's already difficult. It's not based on like it's a completely original IP. It's not like it doesn't have like Danganronpa characters or it or like anything like any licensed character in it. But it's like it released in a really, really, really bad state where like there were things about like people like about like the betas that like they completely fumbled on. Like the rates for it were like god awful for like miHoYo style, but they had those miHoYo style lowered rates, but not enough like free income gacha currency for the user base. So it just felt like it felt awful. And alongside that, there were other things that they took out. Like they took out like the skip story function, which people, you know, who just want to get to the game and not necessarily for the story, just, you know, they took that out. And then there were other numerous things that like people disagreed with at that launch. And then they're quickly, from such a dire launch, within the first 2 weeks, have been trying to really turn it around, where like they like increase those rates from 0.3% to 2% for SSRs. And like in a really, you can tell there's like a pretty desperate move, because no other game developer in this space does this, is they refunded all free and paid currency that people spent on banners
before the rate changes.
Yeah, before the rate changes. So like to like the beginning of the like this week, like where it changed. So like they gave a set date that says any free and premium currency that you spent rolling on banners, we will 100% refund you on. So, but and we will not take out anything that you roll for. And if you're like if you reach like 50 out of 80 on pity, we will not like reset that pity at all. So people basically use that as a double up to like say, hey, I'm gonna put more money into this or progress in this game as much as possible, so I can roll as much as possible, so I can get that all 100% refunded to me. So I get all these freebies while still getting basically all my currency back, which is like very, very. I don't think I've ever seen like a developer do that in that space. Like they've definitely were some refunds and some very, very key specific instances, but never like a set date of like, hey, we will do this at this date. So basically, people get giving people a deadline of like, take advantage of this now if you want to do this, pretty much. And you can tell that's a pretty fucking desperate move to get to keep people playing. And you know, like I don't know if it's gonna work out for them or not. Like obviously, people's reception in it. I did check out like the full game as well. Like you know, I played it for several hours. I'm like, I'm not personally like a fan of like its gameplay and flow. But you know, it's people have been kind of up and down over like what they like and dislike about it, and they're continually trying to like rehaul and revamp it and trying to like make it more suitable for like, you know, for people to like it. And it's one of those things that's like, I think Tribe9 will be a good case of like, if you don't have your shit sorted out on day one, no matter how much you try to spin it around and even if you do all the right moves within the first 2 weeks of launch, people are not going to come back if you fumble the bag at day one. You need to have you need to establish that trust on day one, yeah, right away.
One thing I will say looking at the Steam page is it's two things stand out. One, it seems like it actually has a decent amount of reviews and it's mostly positive on Steam now.
It was a very different story on day one in the first 3 days, let's say.
Yeah. Two, this has probably the most interesting system requirements I've seen on Steam in the sense that it lists like CPUs and GPUs for the minimum and recommended requirements. And then it says pass mark score over like X amount for minimum and over X amount for recommended. So it's like, that's interesting. It makes some sense where it's like, we haven't specifically tested any other CPUs, but this is a ballpark of what sort of pass mark score you should expect to play this game, which is like,
that's interesting.
I've never seen that on a Steam requirements listing.
Yeah. So I don't know, like maybe in the next month's like, you know, Sensor Tower, because remember Sensor Tower isn't like 100% accurate, so it's very ballpark estimates.
And Sensor Tower doesn't include PC, so if it's doing better on PC, like and it seems like it's doing all right based off of the Steam reviews and how many there are. Like Sensor Tower is only for mobile, so
yeah, that's true too. So yeah, Tribe9. Like I'm glad you mentioned Tribe9. I was like, man, that's a whole can of worms. That game has had like three separate sagas that it's been going through in like the first 2 weeks of full release, where people have gone through the five stages of grief on that, and like it's like one of those weird things in this mobile game community, right, where like people are gonna go like devs listen because they're finally improving their game. It's like it's because their game was failing and they're trying to turn it around because of features that should have been there on day one. Like it's not like a big win that like they're finally listening. It's like they should have listened on day one or before release. You know, they should have like. it's a wild world. So I don't know. I don't know what the future of Tribe Nine shapes up to be. It's one of those games that like I tried to like, and I tried to like kind of give the devs their props on that, but I just can't. I just don't really care for the gameplay. The story and the characters are interesting, but you're not gonna keep me if I'm not interested in the game, and the gameplay is like it's very. Eh.
I will say one other thing, kind of countering what you said, where it's like if you don't have your shit ready for launch, there's like no chance of sticking around. I'm noticing in the list that Adam linked that Wuthering Waves is 12 on it. So that kind of suggests that maybe that's not necessarily true 100% of the time.
Wuthering used to be a lot higher on Sensor Tower, but then like within like its first 2 months. Not to say that the game didn't get better. I mean, but
well, is it in between major content patches?
I don't know where it is now because I don't play it. But like I know 2.0 was a big thing for that game and people really liked it. But it's gradually like ever since launch been falling. I don't know if that means it's like it's doing great or not. Because I don't follow that game anymore, so I have no idea. But
well, I mean,
it's also one of those things. Is like there's a lot of things that they changed throughout it that like probably should have been there on day one to make it a better experience.
Yeah, I'm looking at some other games there, and it's like Blue Archive, it's above Colorful Stage, it's above Infinity Nikki. Well, it's above Nikkei. So I mean I don't know. It seems like it's doing pretty healthy, all things considered.
I mean it's like I said, it's not gonna apply to every game, but I'm just saying that like Tribe Nine is a good example of like because unlike Tribe Nine, like Tribe Nine had two very public open betas before its release. And they took out things from those open betas into day one full release. So it's already been properly documented of like features that people liked, they didn't like. For example, right, the skip story function people liked in that game from the open betas. In the developer letter before the full release of Tribe Nine, they're like, we took it out because we want people to like appreciate the story and like, you know, we want to. It basically, communicating that like we're forcing people to read the story, and it's like that's not going to make them read the story. If they don't want to read the story, get to the gameplay. They're just going to mash through the dialogue.
Yeah.
No matter what, you're just pissing off more people. And then they said we'll consider re-adding it if we get feedback on it. And then 2 weeks later, like, oh yeah, we'll re-add it. It's like you took out a feature that people liked, and then you're like, and now you're just like backtracking it to like you know 2 weeks after release. For a feature that should have been there on day one, because it was there before full release, you know? It's stupid shit like that. Yeah, that like that makes it a different like a sort of different case from like, you know, other case studies of other competing mobile games. And like there's a pretty cutthroat industry, you know, where if you lose trust with your of players who are willing to give you a shot on day one, a lot of those people are not gonna come back, you know. Yep. There's a lot of people that like will play a game daily on like, you know, release or like for however or the early days of that game. And if they miss a login day because they don't feel like it, there's a good chance that a chunk of them will not log in the second day. It's like, oh, I missed a daily login, so I broke my streak, so there's no point in playing again, you know? So like it's one of those sort of things where the space has so many players and so many case studies of player behavior that like you should know what's effective already. Taking out features that people liked before release only to re-add it shortly after is not, you know, it's not helping anyone. So it's just it's a messy, messy cutthroat industry. And new games like this always pop up, including Suikoden. So you really have to establish that trust with people, and the developers really should know better of like not doing this shit. Don't play games with your audience. It's not good because you know what? Play stupid games, win stupid prizes. You know, play games like that with your player base. See your numbers fall. Period. It's It's cutthroat. It's ruthless. You know, people have a million other options on the market. They don't have to be. They don't have to stick around for yours. Anyway, we sort of got off on a tangent there, but we'll see how the Suikoden and Starleap mobile game fares. Like I said, I'm always open minded and willing to give it a shot. I don't know if I'm gonna like it. They really have to prove the case. I mean, it's good that right away they like straight up said, hey, at least you can recruit like all the 108 stars of Destiny right away for free, and don't have to. They're not gonna be gacha exclusive. Nice. It's like one of those things that like during the event stream, they had to communicate to the people who are running it, saying like people are already kind of wary about this game. Is there anything you can say to like ease their fears or make them less worried? It's like I feel like they're self-aware to some extent about this. It's just like very goofy. Other news that happened this week is we got an unexpected patch for each of the 6 Final Fantasy titles in the Pixel Remaster. I didn't really get to skim a lot of like what was updated in this new 1.2.0 patch for FF 1 through 6 Pixel Remaster on Steam. I know like for FF6 they fixed some of like the set events like in the World of Ruin. I think there was something was bugged about that that they fixed. FF4 Pixel Remaster.
They switched like, Rosa's attacks around or battle commands around.
Yeah, I'm like, I don't know what that means. You know, well, how was it ordered before? Are like now and now float will like can be maintained in like map transitions in FF4, which is like it's like really minor stuff. I don't know if any of this has like any big implications.
I think. At all. This is sort of weird, but also I think it is smart for a company with a huge back catalog like Square Enix to like have some sort of, I mean this in a good way, some sort of custodian or some sort of custodial team to basically maintain their Steam ports or any ports of their games and kind of patch them up, tune them up, even if it's years after launch, to make them the best version they can be if these are going to be on Steam for the foreseeable future. Rather than, you know, just one and done, oh, it's out and it is what it is. It's sort of weird that it takes, like, they had this update, there was like the patch to Chrono Trigger had a bunch, Chrono Cross had a weirdly late patch. It took them forever to get to Nier Automata. But like, broadly, I think it's a good idea, even if it is well after launch, to have a team, even if it's just a small team, going to go through these games and patch them up where they can and fix small little issues rather than have them just be niggling little issues forever. So I do think that's I appreciate them doing this, even if it's a little weird for like, oh, why is this only coming out now? But still.
Better late than never.
Yeah. I think it's smart to have someone in charge of making sure their ports are as good as they can be, and you know, as hardware improves and as operating systems change and whatnot, hopefully make sure they're still playable. Else, maybe a weird comparison, but I played it less than a year ago, like Dragon Age Origins, trying to play that on Steam right now is a problem. And then you get into all this whole talk about, you know, preservation and things like that. Like, right. Just because it's on Steam doesn't necessarily mean it works very well anymore. And obviously, I know these games aren't old, the Pixel Remaster specifically aren't that old, but still, having that maintenance is good. I applaud it.
Yeah, like I like it. Like why, like your example, like Dragon Age 1, for example. It's just like you don't. Why subject people to that when, like, you know, you could. Why not just take some time? I mean, I know the answer. It's going to take time and resources, and we don't want those resources taken away from any other thing. Right. So why even bother when only like 10 people on Steam or something are trying to play Dragon Age at any given time? Kind of a bad reason, but I'm with you that I wish there was like better maintained legacy titles if they're going to be on Steam.
700 people are playing Dragon Age Origins right now.
Yep, and they all 700 had to go through.
They had to download the. They had to download the 4 gigabyte RAM executable patch because the game needs it. No.
This is an interesting one. Earlier this week, Akihiro Hino, the CEO of Level 5, unveiled a new 5-star workshop devlog, which is basically they're gonna ostensibly a centralized location to share stories about their upcoming titles, like a development blog sort of thing. So he kind of goes on about Fantasy Life I and Inazuma 11. So
is this in English?
Yes, this is in English. I can link it to you.
Okay, because I know they had a devlog specifically for Inazuma in
English. Each game had their own specific log, like Megaton Musashi also did. Okay. So each of the game's official websites had a blog, showcasing updates and whatnot. And I believe those blogs will still remain like that, for game-specific updates and detailing them. But I think there's a centralized blog for more broad scope, development blog. Detail posting. So, for this one, there's going to be a new upcoming stream for Inazuma 11 coming on April 11th, 2025, finalizing the release date and final specs and so forth. So, that's all well and good, and I'm very interested to see, what they have to share. But Hino had a lot to say about the development of Fantasy Life I. He's saying that, it's the final stage of development, they're just they recently announced it for PlayStation 5, 4, Xboxes, and Steam, because it's previously a Nintendo Switch exclusive, and announced that it'll support cross-save and cross-play across all those platforms, which is good. But he was very blunt about this, because as people know who have been keeping up with Fantasy Life I, this has had a troubled development where it's been announced ages ago, but it's feel like it's been an eternity for this game to come out. And he said, and one of the things he detailed in this blog is, I quote, "In mid-2024, Fantasy Life faced an unexpected challenge. At that time, producer Keiji Inafune left the company, and we had to reassess and restructure the project." So he goes on about, having internal test layers get, the even harsh evaluations. And, it was clear that, they had to do major revisions to it after Inafune's departure from Level 5. So, since then, they added that explorable open world, they restructured the game's progression, added parkour-style actions, improved core mechanics to refine the scenario. So, it's one of those, when you read between the lines, and it's not very hard to read between the lines here, but, Hina's saying, after Inafune left and left the company, I took over as producer, and we had to basically overhaul the game in the middle of last year to get it to where it is now and for release.
I mean, he pretty much sounds like he's throwing Inafune under the bus. So
of course a lot of people had a lot to say when they read this of oh man, this is scathing. He's obviously he says it in the most professional way possible, but he's saying Inafune did not fucking do this game justice at all, and I had to step in and basically get this game to the finish line and make sure it's in a great spot there. So, another new milestone in the saga of Keiji Inafune.
Hopefully the last.
Yeah. And Keiji Inafune has been them for quite some time because after his failed Mighty Number 6 Kickstarter project, he went over to Level 5 Concept. Forgot what year that was.
Well, Concept was bought by Level 5, and it's funny how many people I know didn't even realize that was a thing until this specific announcement.
I forgot that. I forgot that Concept was bought. Right. As I remember, they were working on a mobile game as well during that time.
I don't even necessarily think, with the information we have about Level 5 over the last couple of years, if it's necessarily fair to blame Fantasy Life on Keiji Inafune. Because remember in 2023, like at TGS, like proper, they were telling me, like, well, publicly they were saying, yeah, all of these games are coming out this year. And then at TGS, I was asking people at the show floor, so this is still coming out this year? And it's like, maybe not. Even though publicly they hadn't announced the delay yet, and it took several weeks for them to announce the delay. So when that's a situation, and that's like on like management, I don't necessarily think, like, I'm not defending Inafune here, God no, but it does strike me as a little bit shitty that they're throwing him under the bus here when, it, by all accounts, it seems like Level 5 as a whole company has had management issues for the last couple of years.
Yeah, I mean, for sure. I agree with you that I don't think it's like, I don't think Inafune is blameless, but I don't think it's all on him as well. But there's definitely been like a sort of like a fissure in development, I guess is the best I could put it, of like how, like, through their internal tests, they're saying this game is not great, you know, and I don't think it's like one of those, it's like, you know, went in and like rescued the project. It's like a lot of little things that like had to like be aligned, whether it was like how Inafune, like, you know, managed the development, what he conveyed to Hino, what's the status of development, and how he and what his directives were to, you know, the teams who worked under him under this project. It's like a project's like unfavorability is not always at the, it's very, very, very rarely at the cost of like one person. Like, it's never really like, hey, a single person is responsible for why this thing is, and if we had a different person, it would definitely turn it all around. Or if we had the right person, it would definitely turn it all around. Just one person, you know. But it's one of those things that's like the way that Hino describes it. It's not to say that Inafune is solely responsible, but that there's definitely a lot of things that he had to turn around ever since he left the company. And he was frank, like, hey, here's what we did to the game after I took over as producer. But hopefully Fantasy Life I is great by the when all is said and done. This is coming out May 21st. Still a bit of time left before its release. I'm hoping that it's a blast to play. It was just one of those like very weird, unexpected, very rarely seen like moments of transparency, especially directly by the CEO of Level 5, where it's like in this blog, it's like, yeah, this is going on. It's like, okay, damn, you know.
The impression I'm getting from Level 5 over the last couple of years, and like the quality of the games that they have released, it seems like has been genuinely pretty good. But it strikes me that from the top down, the company is maybe a little bit too eager to like over adjust games, if that makes sense. Because like reading between the lines with Fantasy Life, like, part of the reason why it kept getting delayed is they wanted to keep making it better, which that's all well and good. But also the reason why Deca Police was delayed was they got such good feedback from TGS, and I kind of feel fucking responsible for some of that. Yeah. That they were like, oh, we need to put a lot more budget in this. We need to make this bigger, better.
Might be some scope creep. Like, you can definitely see that, like, with Fantasy Life, like, you know, adding all this stuff to it.
I don't think people ever wanted parkour in fucking Fantasy Life.
Maybe it's awesome. I don't know. Maybe it's gonna be the best thing about the game, and then like, fuck, they were right.
Man, I will play this just because ever since I've started doing TGS, I have unfortunately grown an appreciation for like how like funky Level 5 is with how they develop stuff, and I do want them to succeed and whatnot. So I am interested in this, and in addition to pretty much everything else they're doing, like,
maybe I want everyone to at least, you know, if there's one thing to get out of Level 5, like, make cross save and cross play just on universal.
Yes. Standard. Yeah, that is the real reason why you should buy Fantasy Life I, is to tell the industry that that is a good thing and that more people need to do it.
Yeah, that's why more people should get Megaton Musashi. Damn it.
Yeah. Maybe they'll actually send out review codes for Fantasy Wi-Fi.
Maybe. It's a tall order.
Yeah.
We have already a sales update from Capcom on Monster Hunter Wilds. barely released. They said on March 4th, which is what, like 3 to 4 days after it came out, that it has already sold more than 8 million units in 3 days. And that is the Monster Hunter Wild selling more than 8 million units in 3 days, making it the fastest in Capcom's history. Which is unsurprising. I mean, this was the biggest title that they had this year. They kept, you know, hyping it up ever since they first unveiled it. Congratulations to Capcom, you know, for... we'll see how high this goes. I believe World reached over 25 million, maybe? I forgot what it was. I know it's over 20 million, but I forgot what the final number was. What the final documented number was for Monster Hunter.
I can look it up real quick.
Yeah.
But
I believe it was 5 million within like the first week or something.
Yeah, I can see that. But I'm trying to think of like what the final number was for documented one was for World and how high maybe. I wonder if VODs could surpass World, I guess, is the real thought I'm getting at. I don't know. It feels like a high
28 million.
28 million for World. We'll see. And of course, that 28 million is probably accounting for Iceborne as well. I think, right?
I need to check. Yes. It includes that 28 million includes the Iceborne Master Edition. But
okay,
like a combined pack.
Yeah, the Iceborne Master Edition counts because it does come with the base game too. So it's like, that's fair.
Yeah, and you know, I'm sure Wilds will eventually get that as well when its eventual expansion comes out, and then they'll probably have a bundle where that lands. But yay, you know, people have been enjoying it. A lot of people seem to like it. Good on them. You know, I still play it. I still play it.
It came out a week ago. I know you got it early, but
yeah, I know. I've been still playing it, just like at the very, you know, very very end game stuff. Just farming decorations and just like mindlessly hunting. So it's been fun. It's been interesting to see how the meta has been evolving in that game, where people have been finding out, like, hopefully Capcom starts bug fixing this game, because there seems to be a lot of attributes to it that are not working properly at the moment.
If you are playing on PC, there's two mods at a minimum that you should download. Special K, which isn't really a mod in and of itself. It's like a tool that if you play on PC, you should probably just have it anyways, because it's useful for like most games. If you want to cap your frame rate, the in-game frame rate cap is terrible. The frame pacing is terrible. Monster Hunter is one of those. Get Special K to help like smooth out some of the frame times. And then RE Framework disables some of the anti-tamper stuff, which also helps with the frame times a bit.
Yeah, so I got RE Framework.
Yeah, so those two things doesn't fix the game by any means, but it makes it so that if you can get it running in an acceptable state, the frame pacing is better, which is a pretty massive deal.
I would assume most people don't care about this unless you're in Capcom's boardroom, but last year, ending 2024 fiscal year, they achieved their 7th consecutive year of record high profits and their 11th consecutive year of profit growth. I'm just wondering, like, how long can they maintain this? Like, this year they had Monster Hunter Wilds, so they're probably going to get 8 years of profits, 12 years of growth. Next year they'll have updates and expansions to grow that. It's like, eventually you're going to hit a wall.
Yeah, well, next year they'll have like Onimusha.
Yeah, they have Onimusha, and then they'll have, you know, they'll have the catalog sales.
Probably
yeah.
Like a Resident Evil or something. And...
yeah.
what other Capcom stuff is hitting this year after Wilds?
Fiscal year. So like Wilds is the last thing of this fiscal year. Next fiscal year, Onimusha is probably the biggest thing. I'm guessing Okami's not coming out quite yet.
Okami is not going to be coming out until like probably 2029 at the earliest, as I'd
wager. Yeah, it seemed like they just concepted it. But yeah, Onimusha seems like the big thing for like next year or next fiscal year. So
yeah. Okay. Wizardry Variants Daphne, which previously released on iOS and Android several months ago, is now available on PC via Steam, and you can transfer over your progress from that mobile version over to the Steam version if you're waiting for that. This has been an interesting success story for the studio. The studio, I don't think, imagined this game to be as successful as it currently is. There seems to be like a lot of like praise for this game. Like, hey, like they actually did like kind of knocked it out of the park with this Wizardry mobile game, which is now on PC as well. But people seem to like it a lot. What they're doing here, like I watched my friends play some of it and explain some of its systems and how it works. It's like, this is kind of wild. So good on them for finding success in like what seemed like an impossible assignment of making Wizardry, like, you know, a pretty successful, popular mobile game.
Yeah, I've heard great things about this, and I might actually try it now that it's on PC, because I'm never going to play a dungeon RPG on my phone. I'm sorry, you can't make me. I have heard good things, and just as much as I hate gotchas as a concept, the absolutely unhinged idea of what if we took a Wizardry and made a gacha game, but it's very much still a Wizardry and all that entails. It's like, that is like more, that makes me morbidly curious. And I've heard from other people that are also similarly into like dungeon RPGs, blobbers, whatever you want to call it, that it genuinely is a good game despite all of the gacha gunk. So
it's wild. So good on them. We got a release date for Puella Magi, Madoka Magica, Magia, etc. That is launching on iOS and Android March 27th. It is eventually coming to Steam, but that will follow at a later date. And this is for people who don't know, this is the upcoming free-to-play mobile game that looks a lot like Honkai Star Rail and its battle system. People jokingly call it Madoka Star Rail. It's definitely, you know, they've definitely looked at Star Rail and maybe kind of copied some of its notes when creating this game. So we'll see how that turns out. It's coming out fairly soon. I like Madoka, so I'm going to be dumb and play it and hopefully like it. But I'm very wary because their previous game, the same developers between Magia Record, Pokelabo, and F4 Samurai. I think F4 Samurai was Magia Record. They pretty much sort of copied Fate Grand Order when making Magia Record. So they definitely looked at like the success of that game. It was like, oh, we can do that, and it was pretty successful for several years in Japan. It did come out here in the West, but it got shut down because it was a late release. Plus, you know, it was a separate server from the Japanese one. This one seems to be a combined, like, shared server with Japan, so because it's going to have a worldwide simultaneous release in this case. So here we are again, a new mobile game based on the Madoka Magica IP that's clearly inspired by a more successful mobile game. Here we are again. The more things change, the more things change. You also have a release date for Progress Orders. This is the guild management RPG developed by Hakama and published by Bushiroad Games. That is coming out on April 10th worldwide for Nintendo Switch and PC. This is one that you decided, like, you wanted to report on.
I posted this because Bushiroad did not announce it themselves. Serious. This game is coming out. They have not announced this. They just forgot to announce this.
Yeah, because Bushiroad has announced that's coming out in Japan that day, but they just completely forgot to market the Western release date of this game. And you looked at it, you're like, what the fuck is going on?
I mean, okay, so the Switch eShops have it for the 10th. The Japanese release date is the 10th. The Steam page has it for the 10th. There are English screenshots, so it's like, okay, looks like it's translated. I don't know if it's translated any good, but it's translated. You know, the Steam page says it has English text, so it's like all signs point to that it's a global release, but the English Bushiroad YouTube Twitter, social media, and press release, nothing. They have not announced this game. It looks like
it has an ESRB rating.
No, it does. So, I mean, as of when we posted it, it didn't have any announcement. Maybe it does now, or it will. I don't know, but it's like a $20 game, so it's a smaller release. I'm the one who described it as guild management because it seems like the type of game where you are basically like send out your character, kind of sits at home on like this base, and there's like a little bit of Rune Factory in there. It's got the Hakama DNA where you're doing some like base building, leisurely sort of things. But the actual gameplay itself is like you're sending out squads out on missions in dungeons and things like that, and you're like kind of controlling them from afar. So that's why I called it like guild management, because it's more like a management sim than an RPG, mm-hmm. at least got a slant like that. I don't really have high hopes for this game because Bushiroad hasn't really the last Bushiroad and Hakama partnership was for Rear Sakai or whatever the heck the English name was, something strange. And that game I heard nothing but terrible things about. Read RPG Fans review. What was that game called in English? It was such
Elementaro's Wanderings, yes, or something like that.
Yeah, rolls off the tongue. But yeah,
I don't remember that.
Anyways, yeah, this game will come out. I don't have high hopes for it. It's kind of mildly interesting in a morbid way where it's like, what is this game? It's kind of different. They're not even advertising it. They forgot to announce it. I don't know, $20.
But Bushiroad works in mysterious ways, man. I like they announced a new anime license thing. It's like a visual novel based on like the ancient Magus's Bride, I think, earlier this week, that Gamatsu reported. And I'm like, hey, I like that anime. It's like, but Bushiroad is like all in on this like anime licensing plus some original games. Like
you know what Bushiroad is really all in on, and what most of the revenue comes from? Trading cards. They're huge.
Oh, yeah, they're huge. Yes, you're right, yeah.
And I was actually looking through their financial report, and I go through financial reports somewhat regularly, but don't normally run into wrestling in the financial reports. Bushiroad does like professional wrestling events in Japan, so they literally have like pages of like photos of like their professional wrestlers and like their events that they held at the Tokyo Dome.
Bushiroad is such a strange company.
I don't usually run into these sorts of things when I'm looking at video game financial reports, but here's, I don't know, some woman pile driving another woman. Okay,
hell yeah. Bushiroad is like it's like almost a jack of all trades, and like the way that like we describe them, right? Because they're involved with trading cards, they're involved with wrestling, they're involved in video games, both mobile and now console, and they're probably involved in like three other industries that we're forgetting.
They have a lot of merch too, which sort of makes sense. Yeah. They all do, but
yeah. So naturally, but my comparison for them is like Costco and Kirkland. Kirkland makes everything. Costco, they're the Kirkland,
the Costco brand.
Yeah. I for progress orders, the only thing I can say about progress orders is I like the opening movie because I've been getting really into the music group who makes the opening movie, Ave Mujica. I'm really getting into their stuff. That's the only way I remember progress orders is because Ave Mujica is involved with them. I'm like, yeah, Ave Mujica, fuck yeah.
I just remember the RPG fan review of Elrentaro's Wanderings. Quite literally said, this is a waste of my time. Like, they were not very... They were not very... They did not hold back.
I mean, so, Chow didn't hold back either, but he...
No, he imported the... He's like,
you're like, this shit sucks. Like, okay, Chow. But hey, call it as you see it. So, we'll see. April 9th for this. Well, that wraps up this episode of the TetraCast. Talked about Suikoden. Talked about a little bit of Monster Hunter Wild selling like hotcakes. We talked about Keiji Inafune out another job, And Madoka Magica. Everyone's favorite things. Thank you, Adam. Thank you, James, for joining me. And of course, he's left already, but thank you, Chow, earlier for joining us on the Suikoden discussion. You can find us over at our main site at rpgsite.net. You'll find some Suikoden guides, some more Monster Hunter Wilds guides that Mikhail has been championing, kicking ass on. You can follow us on Twitter/X over at RPG site. You can follow us on Blue Sky over at RPG site. We're over on Facebook, facebook.com/RPGsiteNet, YouTube, where you can find listen to this podcast on YouTube via youtube.com/RPGsiteNet. You can go access this podcast on your favorite podcast app. And you can visit our Discord at discord.gg/RPGsite, where hang out with our lovely community, and we're all crossing our fingers that Discord isn't gonna shit itself over the next few years at the threat of selling out and becoming public. Until then, thank you very much. Stay safe. Enjoy your day wherever you are in the world.
If you're playing Suikoden, check out my walkthrough.
Yep, and yes, Adam's walkthrough is. I really like your walkthroughs because they're minimalist. There's no big ass paragraphs. It's all just kind of almost checklist of where to go next. Thank you for that. Until then, ciao.